Welcome to the Trinity Tims. You've got myself, Joe McHugh from Video Celts, on one side of me, Eric Knott from Reed Celtic, and on the other side, on the wing, James Forrest from the Celtic Vlog. So it's been another bonkers week in the world of Celtic. Bonkers wouldn't half describe it. That's just our League Cup semi-final defeated opponents. If you've missed out, they're just launching a complaint based on the findings of the KPI panel, which consists of nutters like pundits, former managers, former players, etc., etc. So that circus continues to rumble on, and so does the Celtic management circus. So just less than two weeks ago, we were sitting in here talking away, debating Brendan Rodgers, Michael Nicholson, and within about an hour of the podcast finishing, there was suggestions, and very quickly we got a Celtic statement, and then we got a mad statement from one of our non-executive directors, a guy with 35% shares that decided to go all in. And 2 weeks later, we've had four matches of Martin O'Neill, three domestic victories, and one typical European runaround. So Celtic still managerless. And apparently the international break is a great time to get business done and bring your manager in. So that's the theory. But since we don't hear from Celtic, or we don't hear from our chief executive or our chairman, we only hear from a golfing non-executive director, we're in limbo. We're all guessing. So Celtic, before the next game, there's a small matter of an AGM, which it would be good to present a new manager to. And then we've got a very demanding week of St Mirren away, Feyenoord away, and Hibs away. That'll test us, absolutely. It could be a brutal week, or it could be a fantastic week where things are made, where the team comes alive, where things all fall into place. That's a glass half full. So I'll pass over to Eric, first of all, for his thoughts. Will we have a manager? Will it be Martin O'Neill, or will it be A.N. Other when Celtic go to St Mirren on the 22nd of November?
I really don't know, Joe, because there's just nothing that you can ever predict with this board. Well, I'll rephrase that. There was once upon a time where everything you predicted happened. You know, we've been doing it for years on end, really, and we've been predicting everything that they're going to do, and 9 times out of 10 it happens. But when it comes to managerial decisions, if we were to go by the predictions that we usually use, I'd be very worried, because I think when Neil Lennon was our interim manager back in 2019, a lot of us predicted that disaster could happen there, and so it transpired. So I don't really want to make any predictions on how they're going to do this. If I was to look at it from the perspective of Martin O'Neill anyway, I would think that he's going to be there for the cup final, all right. I think that that's inevitable. But it may be a case of he's there for the cup final with the manager in waiting. The board has 2 weeks now to kind of get their act together and get somebody in. Yesterday, Boise has just dropped in there, so we'll add him in. Evening, Boise, how are we doing?
Hello, how are we? Sorry I'm late. Just kind of getting my emails and get the link, so apologies for that.
You're okay.
Boise, bloody buses. You can never trust them. Never run to timetable. If you're 7 minutes late, that's not too bad. So we're just speculating on whether Celtic will have who'll be in the manager's, the way dugout at St Mirren on November the 22nd. Will it be Martin O'Neill, or will it be someone else?
I don't think they know yet, to be honest with you. I think they've got hopes and aspirations that it'll be someone like a Knutson or something like that. But the confidence I've got of them having anything absolutely lined up, I'm not so sure. I think one of the things with O'Neill getting such an effort in terms of the backroom staff added to his sort of his backroom team in terms of Mark Fotheringham, Stephen McManus, I think there's another one as well. That didn't ever look to me like it was just one or two games. That seemed to me like they probably maybe the best decision they've ever made is they had no faith in their own decision-making process that they'd be able to get a manager swiftly and promptly. I think ideally for them, it would be someone like Knutsson in December at the end of his contract, but I'm not sure if he likes to bat his eyelids and then just gets another bumper extension on his contract at Bodo Glimt. So time will tell, but I'm not convinced that it won't be Martin O'Neill still in the dugout in 2 weeks' time.
I'm about to pass to James. I'm going to pick up something that Eric says. Giving Martin O'Neill the cup final, I remember during that horrible COVID season, we were giving Neil Lennon the cup final, giving Neil Lennon the chance to complete a threat. The way I look at it is, you've got a cup final to present a new manager with, and with all respect, and as soon as somebody says with all respect, it means you've got no respect. St Mirren are a very good team, they're a good effective SPA, I suspect St Mirren would be higher up on the list. So this, a St Mirren Cup final should be a great opportunity for a new manager, but James, you were telling us before we went on air that you've been doing a little bit of research, and you suspect we might have, look, the guy that's getting traction today could in fact be Ange Tour. Tell us about that.
Well, that's what they're looking for. I know that ultimately they're looking for the next big thing, the next big managerial superstar. Where they get him on those different day, I'm not going to say I'll be completely bowled over if we hire him, but he's an interesting guy. That much is very clear if you look at his managerial profile and the style of football he likes in the his whole football guys with a very distinctive style. But he also comes across as a pragmatic guy, because he's always got a plan B and a plan C, which is more than we've seen for quite a while. And his contract, of course, the MLS season ends in December, which charts very nicely with what Strachan has bumped his gums about. And so some of the pieces fit. It's very, very clear that the board is looking for a guy in one of these far-flung corners who has not yet been discovered by the rest of football. This guy, he's managed in Canada, he's managed in the US. He's not made a move to Europe yet, and he's apparently very keen to move to Europe very early in his career, and this might be the interesting option for him. He's certainly getting discussed a lot today. There's reports that he's a Paul Tisdale candidate, which is interesting as well, because allegedly it is Tisdale leading this hunt. And one of the things about this that gives me any encouragement is that we've seemed to have a football person doing a football person's job here and no relying on the Desmond contacts book. So I don't know that we'll have a new manager by the time the international break ends in terms of in the building doing the job. There's no reason why we can't approach somebody like this guy or somebody like Knutsson and make them an offer and get a contract signed and sealed so that the job is done for when the guy can actually step in and do it. I think we need somebody in early December at the latest. O'Neill's talking today about how he's talking yesterday about how he might go to London and speak to Desmond this week. If that's true and Desmond offers him the job on a longer time frame, there is a suspicion that O'Neill will turn it down because he doesn't want to come back and take the club on any long-term basis. O'Neill speaks like a guy who thinks the club needs a permanent appointment as soon as possible. And I'm encouraged by that as well, because O'Neill, it would suit a lot of people on the board to appoint O'Neill. It would suit a lot of people. They wouldn't have to do their actual job. They wouldn't have to make any major decision. It would just be, right, well, the stopgap is now the permanent option and we'll see how long it lasts. I would very much like that matter taken out of their hands. If Paul Tisdale's running it and he's got the final say, then it'll be somebody like Wilfred Nancy. It'll be somebody off the wall who'll leave a lot of people scratching their heads, but that might be the best option. That might be the best kind of option we get. It's a lot better than a Stephen Robinson. It's a lot better than a Martin Maloney double act to the end of the season and then get it to Maloney in the summer. That's a better option than I thought we would pursue. And I'm dead set against giving it to somebody in the UK. Dead set against it. I would take McKenna at a push only because McKenna's an outstanding young manager. But it's not a road I want to see us go down again. I would definitely would prefer it if the coach came from outside the UK and he ticks this box and all. So we'll see. We'll see. It would suit a lot of people just to leave them in post. And I know there's a lot of people on the Celtic board who would be quite pleased with that and would take that right now. But hopefully it's not going to be their decision to make.
It's the path of least resistance or least resistance with these guys. I mean, anything that involves work, you know, is just that's kind of alien to them. The fact that they might have to actually put some effort into this process. And like we know that they always take the easy way out when it comes to these, you know, these kind of decisions. And if O'Neill and Maloney are the easy way out for them, it's quite a possibility that that could happen. It wouldn't shock me if it did. I mean, it wouldn't shock me if they told us they were keeping them till the end of the season. And then if Martin O'Neill lands the treble, we just have a repeat scenario of what happened with Neil Lennon in 2019. That wouldn't shock me either.
Mad to say it, isn't it? That's the kind of thing they would do. I mean, that's really... We're all sitting here and we're thinking about Martin O'Neill winning a domestic treble and the downside of that might be...
I know. But this is the PTSD that we suffer from.
Crazy, man. Absolutely crazy. It's a legitimate concern.
If the Celtic board are presented with an easy option, they're going to grab it. So it'll be very interesting, the timetable just now. What Martin O'Neill's doing down in London, and what is he going to adapt cupboard for a couple of days and then he's come out on Thursday? So he talks in so many riddles. But James touched on it there. But boys, who do you think is going to make the decision? Is it going to be another Dermot Desmond production? Generally, he's been pretty good. He's been very good with the guys he's appointed as manager. Unfortunately, putting them into the Celtic structure has been a bit of an issue. Or are we going to be looking at the good doctor, the former Exeter City manager, to check through his analysis, check through his data, and come up with the guy? There's so many characteristics needed to be a successful Celtic manager that... I'll say analytics is maybe 40-50% of it, but you need to be sitting in front of this guy and ask them hard questions. And hopefully Brian Wilson and Tom Allison aren't the ones asking the hard questions. But boys, ultimately, do you think it'll be a Dermot Desmond verdict, or do you think the club will hand it over to Paul Tisdale or some sort of committee within the club to make the appointment?
I think the fact that's even a question tells you just how little faith we've got in Celtic's sort of football and operation at present with the current incumbents in the board. It just seems ridiculous to me that we've got a scenario where there's a football guy, and James is absolutely right, who potentially, it looks like right now, the word on the street is could be about to make a football decision. Maybe the first one since he joined. Not sure I can remember too many others of note that I've heard about. And that could all be trumped, essentially. And, you know, it's not a bad pun, that one, when it comes to Dermot Desmond. Just wading in and deciding, actually, you know, you've done so well, Tisdale, but here's my guy, and we're going to go for him. And I just think that sort of absolute power to have when you've got 35.4% or whatever it is of a football club is silly. I think it shows as well from Celtic, if ever they were in any doubt that their communication, their transparency, and the lack of direction could be highlighted anymore, is that you guys who've wrote about the club for so many years, know everything about it inside out, do this for a living, are sitting there scratching their heads, asking me on here, going, who do you actually think picks the manager at Celtic? That is utterly bonkers to me that can be. I mean, I think when you put it like that, it should hopefully register home with some people that the main problem here, and always will be, is the guys that are picking the manager, or we think picking the manager between them, they're the problem right now. And whatever manager goes in there, all they're gonna do is start off with a positive note, start off shaking hands, and the hand that they shake of the board, they'll end up having tied behind their back within a year anyway. So there is no, for the way I see it, with all best intentions, the most hope I would have of the manager being a success would be by Tisdale. But remember, at any point, even if it is a Tisdale appointment, they can wade in and go back to true form, and that makes managers' lives hard, no matter who it is. At this moment in time, I'll go with what James said. I think it looks like it could be getting led by the football guy, but without sitting on the fence, I really don't know when it comes down to actually the final decision, because I still think there's many wee twists and turns that this can take. But yeah, damning that we don't know.
Yeah, no, it sums it up. There's no communication. There's no structure in place. It's guesswork. You're trying to read into this, that, and the next thing. And I think Derek McGregor and the Sun today was putting a jigsaw piece together. And Tisdale's got connections to Nancy's or Nancy or whatever. We'll call him Wilfride. We'll call him WN. That should save any confusion. So Tisdale's got connections to WN's assistant manager, but it's a bad day when a former Exeter City manager that we know nothing about, he's been in the job for over a year now, hasn't said a peep, and we're all just trying to guess it. Is he involved in transfers? I mean, when Tisdale came in, his remit included rejuvenating the academy and producing Champions League players in the fair play to the academy team. They beat Albion Rovers 2-0 at the weekend. That was in the back of losing 4-1 at Clyde Bank. So might have a few Champions League players ready to come through. But Eric, do you think it's going to be a Dermot Desmond production, or are you just? I mean, none of us know. It's just your interpretation, the signs that you're reading.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's. I did a fairly extensive article yesterday where I kind of fleshed out, you know, at that time, or I don't know if it's still the case, but the bookies' favourite is Kjetil Knudsen. And I sort of looked at, you know, it from the perspective of, we know how spiteful and vindictive Dermot Desmond can be, right? And I kind of posited the idea that would Dermot Desmond just go all out to get a really good manager just to give Rodgers the finger? And then following that, would he actually give that manager a pile of money just to say to get it right up Rodgers, you know, and basically out of spite, similar to what he did on the back of the 2016 Scottish Cup semi-final. He was so wound up by the way the Ibrox directors celebrated in the box, apparently that's the story that's going around next door, in the box next door to theirs, that he just turned around and said to the guys, I want a manager who's going to whip these guys' asses next season, and he got Rodgers. So we all know, we don't know 100%, but the rumours are abound that he does operate off spite. He can be vindictive. We all saw that back in 2020 when he wouldn't let Lennon go, when we knew Lennon was a busted flush. So what that kind of goes back to is the guy doesn't think straight. It's not that he doesn't think straight. He thinks, I think everything has an ulterior motive in the way that he thinks. It's to get at someone, it's to upset someone, it's to prove something. And right now, Rodgers is public enemy number one, clearly, with Dermot Desmond. So maybe Desmond will be able to prove Rodgers 100% wrong. And he'll make an appointment that's going to blow us all away on that basis. Not on a footballing basis, but just to prove Brendan Rodgers wrong. And you could see him doing that because that's based on his track record. But that, you know, I said, like, with Kjetil Knudsen, his whole contract at Bodo Glimt, like, is based on the fact that he has the final say and he's heavily involved in player signings. Now, if he was to walk into a room with Dermot Desmond and start negotiating with Dermot Desmond, do you really think that Dermot Desmond is going to agree to with him? Say, you know, if he says, look, I want a contract where I have the final say when it comes to player signings, where I'm heavily involved in player signings. Basically, I want autonomy when it comes to player signings. Similar to what Ange Postecoglou had when he came in, and we saw how quickly that was scuppered. We saw how quickly that team was sold off. But that's why somebody like Celtic's not going to change. If we remain with the same directors and we remain with Dermot Desmond in charge of the club, which, as Boyce said earlier on, I mean, it's ridiculous that he has the level of power that he does over the club. But if he remains in charge of the club and he remains with the same board of directors and they aren't changed, the club isn't going to adapt to somebody like Kjetil Knudsen. It's not going to adapt to the way that he operates, because the whole operation of the club operationally would have to change to suit a manager like him. So I don't see that happening. Wilfried Nancy, I don't know. James, you seem to have a fair idea of what this guy is like, but is he going to be a guy who comes in who's a yes man? Is he going to be a guy who comes in?
The absolute blueprint manager is architect. His teams have to play a style of football, so he needs the players that can play that style, and he won't settle for less than that.
Yeah, and that's the same with Knudsen. Knudsen has a certain style. He plays, like I said yesterday, he plays a 4-3-3, but he's very much about his players fitting into the system. And we've discussed often enough about, you know, square pegs going into round holes and Rodgers not having the players that he required to fit the system that he had, and that's why the system failed. Knudsen is going to require the same. From what you're saying, Nancy is going to require the same. And that, to me, is just something that Desmond and the board are not adaptable to doing. They're not going to give someone autonomy over player signings and over recruitment. And that is going to be the stumbling block going forward. That's my view on it. So therefore, that leaves me wondering who the hell they're going to bring in that's going to suit their agenda. So that's my view on it, Joe.
A very quick sales plug. We're 30 subscribers short of the magical 2,000. I think Boise Bus is well past 2,000 or thereabouts. So if you can give us a little subscribe, if you can give us a thumbs up, I normally just put this in at the end of the show, but I've remembered something this time. So if you can give us a subscription, if you're already subscribed, give us a thumbs up and put in a comment or come back later on with a comment. But on a slightly different tack, we've got Boise with us today, so we're going to make the most of them. Boise, what was your reaction on Friday, around about tea time, when the Celtic board decided to launch another attack on the Green Brigade? There's been very, very selective, the evidence that Celtic have put up. On Saturday, it emerged that there is video and photographic evidence. On Axon today, I heard Kevin Graham say that he's saw some of the video clips of the incident, and he says that it doesn't paint either side in a very good picture. So what was your take on the speed of Celtic's reaction? So it took them six, seven months to produce the Fairhurst report after the kettling of fans on London Road. And for a game last Wednesday against Falkirk, the following Friday, they brought in a blanket ban on about 600 Celtic supporters, when at most the evidence they presented was 80 to 100 people leaving their seats to go to the concourse. So be good to get your take on it. What was your overall view of it, and how the story's evolved since Celtic came up with a statement and their ban?
I don't think any of it's any coincidence that they know that the people in question are very much of the sack the bold sort of fans collective movement. And I think right now anything that they can do to dilute those voices and find any excuse for a ban and over exaggerate potential sort of crimes, if you want to call it that, or whatever, I think they'll do that right now. They're in a position where they're trying to damage limitate how loud the voices are of the sack the bold chants, the consistency of it, and see little things like this. They think that's going to win, because if you take that element out, who starts the chants? Who's got the... And they're challenging basically the movement as a whole right now. And I think Celtic have doubts about the longevity of the fans collective. And they've got two ways of going about this right now. They can silence certain aspects of it. They'll never be able to silence a huge percentage, but undeniably, Joe, you could get something like 600 done like that, and it does have an impact. Oh, so they thought, of course. The Green Brigade were pretty tactful in managing to find their way back in at the stadium, which I thought was wonderful to see as well, and I hope that cheesed them all right off at boardroom level. But they've also got another weapon that they can use as well, which I'm more fearful of than these ones. I think when Celtic go down the road they did Friday, they unite the movement more. And I think Celtic's other weapon that I've already seen whispers of will be things like, let's reopen talking about the Celtic end and things like that. And that's where they're going to try and kill the movement with kindness. And I'm not saying it would work, but I'd be far more wary of Celtic going down that road and making compromises and quid pro quos, if you like, as opposed to them going down the road of what they did Friday. Because for me, I just smirked when I seen it, and I just thought, this is perfect. You're back playing in our hands again. With Martin O'Neill, you could see at first everyone's going, oh, that's a good move by the club, in the sense of your heartstrings are obviously going to get pulled straight away with Martin. You don't want to see his legacy tarnished because of toxic atmospheres at the game. So it was a clever move in the if you look at the debate between the collective and the board in isolation, that was a good move on the chessboard, I think, to get O'Neill back. But that one on Friday, yeah, I think that just creates vigour. It just reminds you of why the collective was set up, why so many people signed it, and more of the same, please, from them, because it didn't get adhered to. It got overcome by, obviously, if you've seen the footage, obviously tickets were given at the Green Brigade anyway, so I was delighted to see that personally. And I think there would have been a lot more hashtags of sack the board on throughout all the social media platforms after that on Friday. And to be perfectly honest with you, whatever it takes to do that and get that trending as much as possible, I'm all for. So well done, Celtic, to me.
100%. The Celtic collective has been brilliantly fueled by the club's boards. The collective didn't even have a name on, I think it was the 3rd of September when the letter, or the open letter, went out, signed by about 100 different groups. And that would have been a little bit irritating, but following that, we had the Friday story in The Sun undermining Brendan Rodgers, and then the Saturday Celtic statement warning us that we were in the brink of falling foul of UEFA financial fair play. The way that the way the board has reacted has built the collective fantastically. They quickly got a meeting, and the minutes of that meeting was absolutely horrific. Anyone that was wavering and saying, oh, I think one of the first plans was to paint the collective as noisy teenagers, it's the ultras guys, it's those guys looking for pyros, looking to own Celtic Park, looking to run it their way, but it's far from that. Various podcasts, including this one, have had more mature members of the collective on board and explaining what's going on. And the collective is such a broad church. There's so many different people, different ages, and every daft action that the Celtic board comes up with seems to strengthen the collective. So I'll pass over to James. I'm sure he's got more than a few views. James, what to be said, James is no fan of the Green Brigade. He's been highly critical of them many times, and he takes a bit of a pasting for speaking out against the Green Brigade at different times. But James, unlike others, James will review every incident on its merits, and you can speak for yourself, James. I'll let you go.
It's weird, you know, you should say that, because I've been reviewing past incidents on their merits as well now in the last couple of days. And the mayor, I reviewed them, and the mayor, I speak to people who were at the centre of them. The mayor convinced them that the club told myself and other members of fan media a bunch of lies about the last incident, about the one for which the Green Brigade have their suspended sentence. And it's just and it's just one of the things that I've been curious about for a wee while. And I've never actually had a chance to test the theory, because obviously, as you say, I've been highly critical of the Green Brigade guys quite a lot in the past. And it's only recently that I've started getting a couple of them, a few of the main guys through the collective and whatnot, and spoke to them about a lot of things. And I'm starting to put things together a bit that I've been theorising in my own head about for a wee while. And the more information I get, the more convinced I am that the incident for which they've abandoned in the first place was grossly misrepresented by the club and the way they presented it to fan media to sell that idea on their behalf. And I was one of the guys who did quite a good sales job on their behalf. And I knew Hank, I got bullshitted. And I don't like it. And I don't like the idea that people at the club thought they could get away with that indefinitely. I've been suspicious about it for a wee while. But the mayor of Ireland and the mayor here, the mayor convinced them that it's the case. There is a wee analogy I like to use at times like this. King and his advisor are in a tower looking down on all the peasants at the bottom of the castle walls who are clamouring to get in, break down the door and lynch the pair of them. And the king says to his advisor, like, how the hell are we going to fight our way through that? And the advisor says, we're not going to. We're going to tell the guys with the pitchforks that the guys with the torches don't like pitchforks and want to take their pitchforks away. And by the time they're finished with each other, we'll just walk out through the middle of it. And that's what our board is trying to do here. It's a transparent attempt at divide and conquer. It really is. It's pathetic, right? And as you highlighted a moment ago, Joe, right, people who have actually seen the footage, the actual proper footage, as opposed to the wee bit that the Cub released, which doesn't really show you anything, and it's not supposed to show you anything. Your imagination is supposed to join up all the dots there. And if you dislike the Green Brigade, you will see Green Brigade. In your head, you will see Green Brigade members piling in for no reason other than to rescue their comrade who's getting rightfully arrested. And if you are more sceptical towards the board, you'll just see a bunch of guys running down there to find out what the hell is going on. I am sure the real footage doesn't paint either side in a good light. But that's all the more reason to treat what the club is saying with the deepest amount of scepticism. Because the club has already lied about stuff like this before, and we now know that. That's a fact. The club has at least intentionally misled fan media before on this subject, and that also is a fact. And at this moment, it's not a coincidence that this has happened at this moment in time. And when you look at the communications that the Green Brigade has released between them and the club that went on in August, it's pretty clear that the guys in the Green Brigade saw the potential for flashpoints and incidents and willingly went to the club in an effort to de-escalate them before they happened. And the club has ignored it. The club, to a certain extent, has provoked this and is now trying to use it as a weapon against not only the collective, but against the broader support as a whole. And it's such transparent nonsense. It's dreadful. And the worst thing about it is that they've resorted to collective punishment, which is in itself a piece of absolute nonsense. This is the second time in the space of a few weeks that the club has released this. A statement has gone out on the club's official website, which states opinions as legal facts. And it was as dangerous this time as it was when Dermot Desmond's statement called Rodgers a this and a that and made all sorts of allegations against him. To actually stand up some of what they have said in this statement, they need court cases and legal fact, and they don't have either of those things. And even if they had court cases and legal fact, that would only entitle them to ban the people who are named in those court cases and who are, as a legal fact, involved in this incident. And a collective punishment against hundreds of people for the actions they were, at most will be about 20 or 30, is bollocks. It's ridiculous. And it doesn't matter whether you like the Green Brigade or not. It doesn't matter whether you agree with their politics or not. That is just an injustice, no matter which way you dress it up. And if it's not all right for it to happen to you, then it's not all right for it to happen to them. It's disgusting.
Well said, James. Eric, I'll throw it over to you. How unusual is it that a police officer, possibly two police officers and a steward, were assaulted inside Celtic Park at the Falkirk game and not a peep of it got out? No charges were made, no arrests made. And then on Friday, Celtic came up with a ban on 600 people based on very little. What's your take on that, Eric?
It's all very strange, isn't it? You know, nobody arrested, nobody, you know, nothing reported really after the game. And to me, and I pretty much agree with the other guys, it all just stinks of they want to silence the biggest voice of dissent, and that's it. And this is their excuse. Like we've said enough times, we waited so long for the Fairhurst report based on the Kettling incidents last March. It took them months and months to get that out. Yet, pronto, a week after the game against Falkirk, we have a ban against the Green Brigade based on allegations that there was an assault on a steward and two police officers. And look, we know how heavy-handed the police officers can be around Glasgow. We also know that if they were assaulted, arrests would have been, you know, I believe anyway that if two police officers were assaulted at Celtic Park, backup would have been called in and there would have been a mass amount of arrests. It's that simple. So to me, this whole thing stinks. It's bullshit. It's all it is they want to silence the biggest voice of dissent. The biggest thorn in their side has been the Green Brigade. The most, you know, the guys produce all the banners, they produce all the chants, everything that's kind of hurting them effectively, or they feel can hurt them the most. These are the guys that can hurt them the most. So they need to silence them. They also feel that they're cutting right down through the heart of the collective by doing this, and that this then will sow disarray amongst the collective and cause us to lose momentum.
That's what it has had. Is emotive language.
Yeah, and we have effectively, you know, it's given us more momentum. Rather than taking momentum away from us, it's given us more momentum because it's going to show strength through unity. And the collective are just going to get stronger off the back of decisions like this from the board. And I can't understand why the board don't actually see that. The more that they go against the grain in this, the harder their life is going to be. The more that they try to split this up, this group up, and this movement up, the more galvanized it's going to become. So all they're doing is shooting themselves in the foot. That's all they're doing. And they're only going to make life tougher for themselves. But it seems to me it's right now because they know I wrote an article on this particular subject on Saturday, and I said we're now living in a tin pot dictatorship at Celtic. That's what it is. And it's on its last legs. It's teetering on the brink of collapse. And this is what happens with tin pot dictatorships when they're teetering on the brink of collapse. It's a scorched earth policy. They literally try to take everything. If they're going down, everything is going down with them. And that's what they're doing. It's all out of desperation. It's desperation to shut the fans up. But the fans are just going to grow louder and louder. The more that they try to silence dissent, the more louder it's going to become. And collective punishment, as you've said, James, and as Boise has pointed out as well, it's ridiculous. There's people who probably weren't even at that Falkirk game who are being banned. And that to me is just, it stinks. It absolutely stinks. People, if one or two or 20 individuals cause problems, then CCTV should be able to pick out the exact individuals, and witness statements should be able to pick out the exact individuals involved. They should be taken aside and told that they're banned. But banning the whole Green Brigade, that just reeks. It absolutely stinks. And again, it's going to backfire spectacularly on them. As I said, they've shot themselves in the foot. This is only going to galvanize the movement further. It's only going to galvanize the collective. And we saw what happened yesterday. Loads of other people gave the Green Brigade their tickets and they got into the stadium anyway. So it appears they'll find ways around it regardless. So yeah, I it's a stupid move from the board. And it just, like you said, James, the language in it reeks. It's similar to the kind of language that was in the statement from Desmond. There's no thought process goes into these statements. They just, you know, and I actually said it in my article yesterday, you know, if any prospective manager is doing his due diligence on Celtic right now, if Kjetil Knudsen was doing his due diligence on Celtic right now, all he needs to do is go onto the website and read the statements and he'll see what state Celtic is in. If he has no knowledge at all about Celtic, he just needs to go onto the Celtic website and he just needs to look at the club statements and he'll see what kind of club exactly Celtic is at the moment.
I'm reminded of one line from our gallant CEO from the minutes with the collective. So this is the agreed club minutes. And one of the lines from Michael Nicholson was, "You don't speak for all Celtic fans." The collective have never said they speak for all Celtic fans, but they've got over 400 groups, whether that's Supporters Association, Irish Association, various individual supporters clubs, websites, all sorts. So they've got a hell of a body of support behind them. But it does seem as if Celtic, Nicholson, Lowell and the rest of them think it's just some noisy minority and they can trample over them and get others to go on board with them. But we've got so much to discuss that I want to move on to the one and only Don Robertson. So Celtic won 4-0 yesterday. It is not, it's not sour grapes. We are not complaining after losing. We complained last week at Hampden after winning 3-1. There's some outrageous decisions on that match, and there's some outrageous decisions yesterday. But one of the big things from yesterday is there's a pattern. There's a very definite pattern. That pattern isn't Don Robertson getting too many Celtic matches. So as a reminder, we've had 11 matches in the SPFL this season. Robertson has their home matches against St Mirren, Hibs and Kilmarnock, and also the Glasgow Derby. But if you want to zoom in, as Eric has done tonight, zoom in on the last two matches that Don Robertson's had with Celtic. Celtic against Hibs, I think it was 75-76% possession, and the full count was 116. Yesterday against Kilmarnock, just to prove that wasn't a one-off, the Celtic had 74.7% possession, just under three quarters of possession, and the full count was 4 free kicks to Celtic and 14 free kicks to Kilmarnock. There's a couple of ridiculous incidents that highlighted Don Robertson and his, I was going to say, a unique style of refereeing. It's a uniquely Scottish style of refereeing because, again, without giving too much away about Eric's article, Eric compared the stats from the Celtic and Kilmarnock game with Aston Villa's 4-0 win over Bournemouth. So there's a few issues here. Why? Well, we know, why does Donald Robertson get games? Because he delivers, he manages event management, match management. He keeps it competitive and reduces the edge that Celtic has. But Eric, tell us a bit more about your article. I've not given too much away and folk race over to read Celtic to look at it afterwards. But what the hell is going on with Don Robertson, and what can we do to get him to apply the laws of the game to both teams fairly?
Well, yeah, I just asked the question, is he the most inept referee in Scottish football, or is he actually quite smart in what he's doing? And to me, it looks like he is quite smart in what he's doing in every game. So what I did was I just delved, as I said in the article, I could have gone deeper, but I just delved into the last three games that he reffed involving us at Celtic Park. And those being the games that you've highlighted, obviously the game against Kilmarnock, the previous game to that was the Hibs game, and the game against St Mirren at the start, the opening day of the season. The game against St Mirren was a little bit lighter in terms of the fouls. It was 10-6. So we committed 10 and St Mirren committed 6. But when you have the following game then from that, which was the Hibs game, you had 16-1. And then obviously you had the game yesterday, which was 14-4. And what I've highlighted before on the podcast is that when you look at professional referees in leagues where they have to declare allegiances, we talked about this previously on the podcast, and we talked about the Barcelona, you know, Barcelona, who are a team who has a lot of possession like us. And we did a foul count in that particular game, and it was something, I don't know exactly what it was, but if I refer to the game yesterday between Aston Villa and Bournemouth, Aston Villa had the more possession than Bournemouth. They won the game 4-0. It was 20 fouls to Bournemouth, 8 to Aston Villa. And this tends to be the pattern in most games where, you know, in the top leagues where professional referees are refereeing and allegiances are declared and there's no bias in any of the games. It stands to reason that the team that has the most possession is the team that is going to be getting chased by the team that doesn't, and they're more likely to commit fouls. So there's a pattern there from Don Robertson. If you wanted to delve deeper into every game that he referees involving Celtic, 9 times out of 10, you're probably going to find out that the foul count was Celtic had more of a foul count than the opposition that they were playing against. And that just seems to be the pattern that this guy has. I'm sure somebody like Alan Morrison has already gone into it and could go a hell of a lot deeper into it. But this is what Don Robertson does. And as I said, I asked the question, is he the most inept referee? Well, I don't think it's ineptitude. I just think it's bias. And he just simply does not like Celtic. He's put in charge of Celtic as often as he is because he doesn't like Celtic. He makes decisions off the cuff like he did yesterday when Dyson Maeda didn't even touch James Brown. And we will all go back to the famous penalty that he gave for Alex Shannock, you know, against Ross County back in 2017, where Eric Sviatchenko was about 2 feet away from Alex Shalik, and Eric Sviatchenko got a yellow card and they got a penalty. And lo and behold, afterwards, Shalik was done for simulation and banned. He got a retrospective ban. But I'm sure if it goes to the KMI panel, like that yellow card would be rescinded because there was no contact between Dyson Maeda and James Brown whatsoever at all. He didn't touch him. Well, as I said in my article, it must have been the vortex or the gale created by him going by that turned Brown upside down. I don't know, but it's obvious that this is the pattern of assistance from Don Robertson to every opposition that we play against. You know what I mean?
I think the only yellow card that can be rescinded is mistaken identity. So I suppose you could stretch it and say it's mistaken identity that Maeda committed a foul. But as a little insight, the perception is that Don Robertson is actually one of us. Don Robertson apparently was brought up being sympathetic to Celtic. So you've got that strange situation where these guys totally flip and go overboard to show how unbiased they are. And Don Robertson has certainly perfected that. I mean, there's so many incidents to pick up on. Midway through the second half, Celtic were breaking away and he pulled us back for an offside that was absolutely useless. I've got to credit one of my uncles. He came up with the term, the disadvantage rule. And Scottish Greg Thompson was the first referee to really go to town in that. But it must be part of the training now. If you can apply the disadvantage rule, you do it. You break up Celtic's play, and equally, the Celtic are looking threatening. You can pull them back for a free kick or an offside. Boise, what was your take on the outrageous performance of Ron Robertson yesterday?
I tend not to get too cheesed off with these situations, and that's probably damning on my behalf, but just because you become apathetic to things when you see them year after year, I know that's not maybe the right attitude, but it's something that you just almost expect now to happen. And I feel that, see the Maeda one, for example, and I think that's the one that's getting the most sort of traction again on the old social media and things like that. I don't understand what it is they think they're seeing there or how they can be that bad at their job. And I take your point when you're saying, if this is someone who's meant to be of a Celtic persuasion growing up, I always wonder, I mean, a lot of people I think see some in the chat as well saying, yep, definitely is. I mean, if that is the case, the numbers that are getting said by Eric, none of it makes, it doesn't add up in terms of the bias thing. Is there almost like, whoever your masters are, because they're aware that you are maybe of Celtic persuasion, are you going out above and beyond your way to impress them and stay in your job by, see, told you I could be impartial. And it's not impartial, it's the absolute reverse of that, but that suits then the paymasters. I don't know.
Wasn't Willie Collum the same? Collum was supposed to be a Celtic fan, and he overcompensated beyond belief in a lot of games. You know?
I don't like getting too caught up in it because I feel as well, I'll tell you the reason for that. See, when I look at Rangers getting beat last week, Sevco, whatever you want to call it, right? Last week, and they were absolutely clutching at every single thing they possibly could and basing it on the referees. I mean, I see it, I think of how tragic it is. So in my mind, I'm like, I don't know if I've made peace with the fact there's a shocking level of biasness or incompetence, and I like to gloat in victory and I like to sort of put my anger at Celtic when we don't get the results that I want, as opposed to referees. I think when I seen that last week, it reminded me of how tragic it can potentially look. But the numbers don't lie that Eric's saying. 4-14, 4-16, and Celtic yet in both those games have had 3/4 of the possession. That can't make sense in any other realm. And I think things like that, it's brilliant that you've got guys like Eric collating it or being able to bring examples like that way beyond my skill set, I tell you that right now. But if you can get more examples like that where you can find games throughout, I think, any corner of the world where you can find games where the home side has 75% possession on average and yet has committed around 3-4 times as many fouls as the away team, and the away team's number of fouls committed in a game they've only had the ball, or the opposition have had, the home team have had the ball 75% of, they've only committed 4 fouls in that time, 5 fouls in that time, in the most woke era of football ever on the pitch, where people roll about, you know, for any sort of contact. I find that astonishing that these numbers could make any sense in the 2025 version of football. So, yeah, and very interesting. But like I say, nothing surprises me. Also,
you know, if you delved, if I wanted to delve deeper, if I wanted to go back to all Don Robertson's games last season involving Celtic, you'd probably see the same pattern.
You know? Well, I'll come up with something. Don Robertson was the referee for Dundee United's recent 1-1 draw at Ibrox. I looked at it at the time, and the foul count fell as you'd expect it. The home team, they had most possession, and they also got most free kicks. So that's my mission tomorrow morning. I'll put together 3 Don Robertson matches. Hibs visiting Celtic Park, Dundee United visiting Ibrox, and Kilmarnock visiting Celtic Park. And that'll tell its own tale. And that explains why Don Robertson is one of Scotland's leading referees.
So James, you also have the Callum Butcher incident, remember, against Dundee United back in 2022 or 21, was it?
The 21-22 Angie's season. Butcher, bye to Butcher, David Turnbull. That was a retrospective red card. And then Robertson also had the Alloa against Celtic match where one of the Japanese players, it was one and only game for Celtic. I think it was only game he started.
Started and finished his career.
Barry Ferguson and Bob Malcolm were in charge of Alloa, so that was a free-for-all. James, now that you've put your phone away, what was your impression of Don Robertson and his bizarre, baffling, strange interpretation of the laws of the game at Celtic Park yesterday?
Well, I mean, there's 2 things, and I'll get to the second one, which is what I was checking on my phone. I'll get to that in a minute, but Alan Morrison has indeed done a very nice study of this, and it was based on Robertson's last performance, as it turns out. And what Alan wanted to find out was whether or not the style of football that we play, which is the high press, especially when we lose the ball, we're usually pressing way up the park, accounts for the number of fouls that we commit. And so he looked at, I think it was the top leagues in Europe and the top clubs in those leagues that play a similar style of football to Celtic's. And the one that was closest to us in number of fouls committed as a proportion of possession and whatnot was Paris Saint-Germain. And even by their standards, we are a massive outlier. So it's just a fact. That is just a fact. This is the current version of patterns of assistance. And we've all talked about how referees don't have to give massive decisions against you to break up a team's momentum. And what I found interesting about Morrison's study on this is that he's talking about how many minutes the ball is in play in these games, right? And I think based on the amount of minutes that the ball was in play, Celtic, who had some like 80% possession in that last game that Robertson reffed, we had the ball for 80-odd% of the game. They had the ball for like 16% or whatever it was. And that accounts for 16% of X number of minutes. And when you broke it down, we had committed a foul every 1-point-something minutes that they had the ball. It's ridiculous. It's mad, right? There's no way that it's legit. There's no way. And when you consider the PSG stat, that we're a massive outlier even from them. And they play almost the exact same way as we do, with the high press and try to win the ball as soon as you lose it. It's nonsensical. To think that this is not happening is to ignore the evidence of your eyes and the hard numbers. But what I was checking, when I was checking the name of a book I've recently started reading, it's called Broken Yard. I was trying to figure out who the writer was. And basically the book is about the Metropolitan Police. And it's about the scandals and the corruption in the Metropolitan Police and how, even though Stephen Lawrence was like 30 years ago and, you know, the culture of racism and all that comments that appeared in relation to that happened decades ago, the culture in the Met hasn't changed at all. It's still the same as it ever was. It's still a culture of, you go along and get along, which means that if you want to be part of that community and you want to be part of that wee unit, then you have to make allowances for all the things that anywhere else you would never make allowances for, which is like racism, misogyny, blatant corruption. If you want to get along within that community, then you need to go by the kind of general standard of that community. And the Met, they're just absolutely shockingly corrupt in almost every way that you can think of. But if you join the Metropolitan Police and you get to a certain level, then you know the only way that you ever progress your career is to turn a blind eye in some cases, actively involve yourself in others and stuff you would normally never do. And it's all because you want to fit in. So a guy like Don Robertson might start off as a guy for Celtic background, but if you want to fit in at the SFA and you want to fit in the Scottish Referees Association, then it's all about go along to get along, turning a blind eye, looking the other way. And sometimes you just need to do what you're told. Sometimes you just need to do what's expected of you as a part of that community and that culture. And that's how it works. That's how all these things work. It's sad but true.
And just as a reminder for...
Every wee bit of corruption goes with the territory the minute you join up.
As a reminder for any non-Celtic fans looking in, that discussion was based on a match that we won 4-0. So there's no sour grapes. It's the best time to highlight these things. And it was equally as bad at Hampden last week, where Rio Hatate was denied a penalty. Ange Balikwisha was denied a penalty. Johnny Kenny should have had an opponent sent off. One tried to break his ankle, and then another one tried to put a knee on him as he casually walked past, etc., etc., etc.
Can I just make one point? I did a fairly extensive article last week on Luciano Maggi, who was the ex-CEO of Juventus, and all the corruption that he was involved in the refereeing corruption scandal back in 2004, and the extent of the corruption that he was involved in and what he did, how devious he was in the way that he even ensured that referees would yellow card certain players so that they'd be banned for the following game so they wouldn't have to play Juventus and all that kind of stuff, right? Now, this is in a league where the referees have to declare allegiance, where the referees are professional, and that league was ripe, absolutely ripe for corruption back then. So to expect us to believe in a banana republic of a football association like the Scottish FA, that our league has never been ripe for corruption and has never been corrupted, and that all these guys are just honest, hardworking guys and nothing goes on behind the scene and they make honest mistakes all the time. If a league as elite and professional as Serie A could be that totally torn apart by refereeing corruption, how do we think that it's not possible that that could be going on behind the scenes in our league as well?
I'll put it another way. It's a disconnect that always bothers me. The disconnect is completely screwed, right? On the one hand, we market our country as having the most intense derby in the world, right? We're a tiny country. There are two massive clubs in this country. Almost everyone in this country who goes to football on the weekend either goes to their club or our club, right? Now, this is how we market the game, through the prism of these two massive clubs. And this idea that we have the most intense derby in the world where the two sides hate each other. On the other hand, we're also told that our referees are the only people in the country who don't have allegiances and who, even if they did have allegiances, would never act on them in any way, shape or form. Such nonsense. The pieces do not fit together. That picture does not. It's not one picture you're looking at, it's two. And that's why the jigsaw pieces don't fit. And we refuse to take even the most basic remedial action, which would solve a lot of the problem, which is to say, you support this club, everyone knows you support this club, you don't have any matches involving them, and you don't have any matches involving the rival either, which might influence title races, etc., etc., right? Very simple. The argument I always hear is, but they might have no referees. Well, you know what? We're a tiny country. If we get to the situation where we need to bring in foreign refs just for those particular games, no one's going to hold that against us. There's no unwritten law somewhere that says we can't do that. It's a sensible approach that keeps the game, at least on the surface level, clean.
There are no referees outside Atlantic Shire.
it takes pressure on officials as well, because you have guys like Robertson who are the subject of massive speculation about which foot he kicks with and all that stuff, right? And you get the same stuff pointed at guys like Beaton and Dallas and Stephen McLean and all these other guys. You could just remove the suspicion completely. If you made them all declare it, if you made them all sign an affidavit that writes it in stone so if they get caught lying about it, they lose their jobs. And you would remove the stain completely for these guys. There wouldn't be any more online speculation because they would never be involved in your games for it to matter. No one would care. Just as it is in England, just as it is in Germany, just as it is in France and everywhere else. And let me tell you something else and all. The idea that we are the only association in Europe whose referees are pure as the driven snow is so arrogant and elitist and nonsensical, right? Because every single major league in Europe, every single one of them, has found corruption in its referees and has at least one major scandal. And I wrote about this like recently, right? It's not as if we don't have major scandals. We just pretend that they're isolated incidents and they're no proof that there's a bigger scandal underneath it all. We've got referees who have been sacked for lying to Celtic managers. We've got the head of referees who was sacked for sending sectarian emails. We've got an SFA chief executive who was brought down by our club for deliberately withholding the registration of our player. We have across the city a chief executive who signed the original EBT documents and then pretended that his association did not know they existed. We have scandals here. We just don't call them scandals. And we just don't look for the big picture that links them on.
We had the biggest scandal in one of the biggest European scandals in the collapse of the old Rangers. You know, and that... And, like, do you mean to tell me that during, let's just say, for example, that time when Luciano Maggi was getting away with what he was getting away with in Italy, that was smack bang in the middle of the EBT era. That was smack bang in the middle of the time when David Murray was running the game in Scotland. And you don't think there was any corruption going on in Scotland? Of course, there was corruption going on through the EBT scheme. But you don't think that he had sway over the referees or that he didn't give any backhanders to referees ever?
It's absolutely crazy.
You're very naive if you don't think that was going on, especially back during the EBT era, anyway.
What right. becomes clearer the more you discuss this stuff is that the only adults in the class are the ones who are actually examining the problem and proposing the solution. Yeah. Nobody else wants to do it.
Right, we're about to move on to our final topic, but before we move on, I'll just suggest that if you're an aspiring referee in Aberdeen or Dundee, the best thing you can do for your career is move to Bells Hill or Wishaw and join the Lanarks of Refereeing Association. Because if you're in Aberdeen, Dundee or Edinburgh, you're not going to get near any top matches. But get yourself a nice job and a house in Wishaw and you're climbing the ladder rapidly. So we'll draw a halt on refereeing issues at that. So we're going to finish up. Apparently Celtic are taking part in the Europa League this season. They've played 4 matches and they've got 4 points and there's 4 matches left to be played. Coming up in December, we've got a run of games, which is Hearts at home, Roma at home, and then St Mirren in the League Cup final at Hampden. And then towards the end of January, in between Europa League matches, away to Bologna and at home to Utrecht, we've got a trip to Tynecastle. So I know what my priorities are. It's those games against Hearts and St Mirren, and that might be me being very parochial, etc., etc. But based on the games against Kaira Almaty, based on 4 Europa League matches, we haven't got a hope in hell of progressing in Europe. And the reward for progressing in Europe would be 2 more midweek matches in February for our threadbare squad. So I'll put it to each of you briefly. Is there any point in throwing everything into these Europa League ties? Or should we just be putting in a token and effort into them and prioritising the domestic matches at the weekend, either side? Over to you first, Eric.
Well, it's like I said, you know, we got schooled on Thursday evening against Midtjylland, a team with a fraction of our resources, a stadium that holds about a sixth of what Celtic Park holds, and these guys are sitting atop the Europa League. And that's basically a reflection of how inept our board is when it comes to actually the way we take part in European competition. So what has happened is, because we are so poor at this level at the moment because of the asset stripping that has gone on in our squad, we're incapable of competing even at this level. which is an absolute embarrassment when you compare us to Midtjylland. I think it's a disgrace. But the problem is that because we're incapable of competing, which was clearly on display on Thursday evening against Midtjylland, people are just apathetic about the whole thing. We've just got to the point now where we don't fucking care anymore. We're not interested in the Europa League. I watched that game and I wasn't in the slightest bothered that we were being schooled by a team from Denmark. And that's bad that I've been reduced. I feel it's bad that I've been reduced to that level of not caring about a European competition, because clearly Midtjylland care about it. What is it about the Scandinavian clubs? When you look at Bodo Glimt, we were talking about Ketil Knudsen earlier on. When you look at these guys and the level that they can perform at in Europe, and we're getting schooled by teams like that. We were schooled by Bodo Glimt before. We've been schooled by Midtjylland before. We're schooled by them again. And these guys work off an absolute fraction of the resources that we have. But the difference is the fraction of resources that they have, they invest in their football team. Their football team comes first. Their football squad comes first. And that's why they perform the way they do. And that's why they have management structures with managers who are really good, like Ketil Knudsen and the guy who manages Midtjylland as well. We're doing a brilliant job with a hell of a lot less than what we have. Because everything is focused on the footballing operation. Whereas at our club, it's not. There's a disconnect from the footballing operation and the board. And that's the biggest issue with Celtic at the moment. And that's why we're failing utterly in Europe at the moment. And that's why we don't care. We're apathetic. We just don't care anymore because we believe we should be in the Champions League, which maybe people will call us snobbish and, you know, tell us, get a grip of yourself. You know, but look at the stature and the size of our club and look at the fact that we're getting schooled by clubs from Scandinavia like we are. And that tells you exactly what. That tells you fundamentally what's wrong at Celtic when it comes to European competition. So I reckon Roma are probably going to give us a hiding. If you asked me what the fixtures were coming up, I couldn't even tell you because I have that little amount of interest in it at the moment. And maybe I should be ashamed of myself. Obviously, if Celtic play a game in Europe, I want them to win. But I think because of what happened and what transpired in European football this season, the way that we lost out to Champions League football and the circumstances under which we lost out to Champions League football, it has made everybody apathetic and it has made people just not care about the Europa League. And that's it. I don't see us getting into the next stage of it. Not unless there's a massive turnaround. Not unless, you know, the management situation is sorted out. We're reliant. The biggest factor about last Thursday evening is that everybody was upset about the fact that a 19-year-old striker was injured. That upset everybody more than the result. But when you put that into perspective, that's where we are now as a club. Because the board reduced us to that level that we were actually reliant. We were excited about a 19-year-old striker. We thought that this guy, and as soon as he came on in that game, he was fantastic. He was pulling the defense all over the place. He won the penalty. And the most upsetting thing about that game was the loss of Callum Osmond, not the result. But if you had said to me before the Cairo game that a few months down the line, we'd be lamenting the fact that we lost Callum Osmond, who hadn't even got a look in, who hadn't even kicked a ball in anger, that just puts into perspective where we're at right now. And it's, you know, it's not the fault of Callum Osmond that, you know, he obviously was working away really hard in the background and he got his chance and he took it. And we were all excited about what he was going to provide. And that's been stripped away now because he's injured as well. And that was the most upsetting thing about Thursday evening. So, yeah, that's my take on it.
Boise, we've got a run of three fixtures coming up. St. Mirren away, Feyenoord away, Hibs away. Where does a Feyenoord match rate in your priorities?
It's annoying because this is incredible how the Feyenoord one is at the bottom of that list. When you actually consider the reasons for it being at the bottom of your list of priorities, the reasons for that are exactly the reasons the board want you to become apathetic to Europe. Take your eye off Europe, guys. See, if you take your eye off Europe, you don't want us sacked because you stop caring about Qaira Almaty results eventually. That's the end game. Is Qaira Almaty qualifiers become apathetic as well? And before you know it, there's never eyes on them, there's no heat on them, and all their bad decision-making, they get away with. So you're going down the road they want you to go down. Rest assured of that. Domestic bliss is what they serve up. You sell an asset a year, they make their profits, they meet their KPIs, and we go again. If we get another treble, they want you to continually feel that glass ceiling of Europe, a glass ceiling that they built, by the way, gets lower and lower. And when we become more apathetic to Europe, the more it suits them. Again, what would the other reason for Feyenoord being the lowest of the priorities? Well, interestingly enough, it's because we're doing so poorly even domestically. So the one thing they did have, their domestic bliss, they've not even got that right. And they can blame Brendan all you want, but I mean, if ever there was a manager with a decent domestic record over the years, it was Brendan Rodgers. So it's some an anomaly for him to be suddenly the main reason or the main culprit for such a despondent start to the season, albeit he has to take his share of the blame as well. But that's two huge negatives as to why the Feyenoord game is the third priority. We're apathetic in Europe because we couldn't get past the team for Kazakhstan in the Champions League qualifiers. We were going for our fourth group stage in the Champions League this season. In doing so, that means we'd banked around £100 million, say, in prize money, TV money, combine it all from each campaign. And yet we invested basically F all, right? We didn't, right, for said qualifier. So the tournament never got treated with any respect. And that's what happens. You then drop down. And the arrogance of this board that somehow, well, don't worry about that. Maybe I'll be running in that tournament. We'll catch them out. The team that just beat us on Thursday there and schooled us, as Eric said, which I think is absolutely spot on. I thought it was a schooling, to be perfectly honest with you. They're 4 years older than the last time we won a knockout match in Europe. That club has been around for 26 years. And we, I don't think we've won, or whatever it is, there's a 4 year gap anyway between it. I can't remember the exact math. But that, if you think in that time, Celtic's domestic bliss, I think someone had actually commented, Joe Devlin, I think it was, in the comments. And he said, the domestic bliss is tainted by the European failure. And I 100% get that argument. We've had our banter years and all that. So, see, when you look back, you go, would you be, you know, if you were, I don't know, say your grandchild, 30, 40 years. Why is it you think that was such a good era? You beat a team that were going through their banter years. That was all you had to come up against. That could be, that's a theoretical argument, isn't it? And what did you do against good teams in Europe? Oh, absolutely nish. We did nothing. We did nothing. We couldn't build from any success. We did nothing. Are you sure that was a good era for the club? And you're like, looking back now, is it? Is it? Is this a club that's evolving on all fronts or knows exactly how to get the fans thinking to go in the direction that they want? And I do agree, by the way, the final of those three games, Joe, is the least priority. And you said yourself, when it comes to Europa League fixtures, you've essentially given up on it. This is what they want. Europe, forget it. Domestic bliss, though, Joe. Celebrate another treble, and how great is everything at Celtic Park again? I think that's what they're looking for, mate. And sadly, we all become a byproduct of that, because you have to inevitably work out what the worst way up, the worst possible outcomes are, and the least sore one would be getting hammered off Feyenoord at the three games you mentioned. Well done, Celtic.
Well done, Boyce. I was reading today, somebody said that the aims of the Celtic board is to, if you want to bring in a James Forrest analogy, it's like a Formula One race, and you want to win the race going at the slowest possible speed. So that's the Celtic way. So I'll pass over to James to finish up this section.
No, it's just that the pit crew are shit.
I'll pass over to James to finish up, and then we'll pass over to our special guest, Boyce, to tell us all about the Boyce bus and when we can catch more Boyce online. But James, what's your take on our Europa League nightmare?
It's worked out exactly as all of us feared it would. When we got knocked out by Kaira, I said then that we were in such a lot of trouble that we would probably have to prioritise domestic success, because it was perfectly obvious that not only were we not cut out for Champions League football, but if we continued on the trajectory that we were on at that point, which, sad to say, the club did, we were not going to be ready for any half-decent level in the Europa League either. And the fact that the transfer window went on for another, what was it, a week or a fortnight after the Qatar exit, and we didn't even bother to prepare ourselves properly for this tournament, was the point where I just went, well, fuck it. If the board doesn't care, then I don't care. Why should we care? I mean, I did this last season as well, right? When a lot of people were talking about how the transfer window had been this great success because Rodgers got the players that he wanted on the final day at the final minute, I still thought there were holes all over the squad. I thought it was a ridiculous statement to say that it had been some kind of triumph because we spent money in the final day. And I vowed that I wasn't going to go to a single one of the Champions League games because I thought, well, the club doesn't take this seriously. I'm not going to take it seriously. And in the event, I went to every freaking one of them. But this time around, I was adamant I wasn't going to attend any of them, and I have no intention of attending any of them. I've even missed out this year on my European trip away, which I loved it. I love going to a European trip away, and I've not even got any interest in doing that in this competition. And the worst day it is, as you said, Boise, we have put ourselves in such serious peril by the way we went about the summer that we're now in a title race, which we should never be in. And what we've got, no, really, the squad is so threadbare, we've got no option but to prioritise. And unfortunately, as parochial and small-minded as it will sound, it's not just that the league is the bread and butter, the league is the whole ball game, right? Because if you don't win the league, then the whole thing is pointless. Next season, I think there will still be two Scottish teams in the Champions League. If I'm remembering this right, there will still be two Scottish teams. But we would, if we finish second, we have to play three qualifiers. And increasing order of difficulty, which we are not remotely ready to participate in. And I don't know if we will be remotely ready to participate in games of that magnitude. If we're champions, on the other hand, I think we have to play two. But they are in a much lower difficulty setting, if you like. And we should, if we do the summer job right, be good enough to get through, regardless. But it's all about winning the title. If we don't win the title, then we're basically clowns trumpsing through a minefield. And fail to win next season's title in that steady Armageddon scenario, because my understanding of that is correct, the team that finishes second doesn't even get into the Europa League, which is a catastrophe on all other level. So for the next couple of years, it may have to be domestic football first, unless we have a really radical overhaul.
It's such a self-made thing, though. That's what's so frustrating. I mean, it's all self-made. Like, this whole, the coefficient points, I mean, we used to laugh, and myself included, that you just keep topping up the coefficient points ranges where your wee runs in Europe and stuff, and, you know, we'll keep winning the league. Yeah. But we did, we contributed nothing towards that like we should have. And this has all came back and bit them. This is what people need to understand. It's not just about Qaira Almaty. Nope. See what James is talking about there when you look at actually what the potential is for how difficult, even if you win the SPFL over the next few years, based on your drop-off in the coefficient standings. That's Celtic as the leader of that league and the winner of that league, 99% of the time in the last 20 years, doing so poorly in Europe that coefficient drop-off has now affected Celtic. That is 100% not the blame of any individual manager. That is 100% to blame the board that have been there the whole time. And it is time people wake up, and I think they'll get a fright when they actually do a wee bit of homework and look at what's coming ahead for the SPFL in terms of your European aspirations and what hurdles you'll need to jump for any sort of qualification in European competition over the next few years, and the drop in those standings that have happened in the coefficient table, the impact it has on our club. And no one's impacted that coefficient points table negatively, in my opinion, more than Celtic. Celtic have underperformed, underachieved, and undertooled up for it time and time again, and now we come a cropper. Again, it's negligence by the board. They are unfit for purpose.
The fact is that for the last couple of years, right, whenever it's been mentioned that we would have when it was mentioned 2 years ago that we'd have qualifiers to play this year, I was already looking at who the likely teams might be based on the UEFA coefficients at that point and looking at all the champions that don't automatically get into the groups. So I was looking at it and I was thinking, we've got to beat all of those teams. Well, I don't know what we would be worried about having to play through a qualifier. And then after Kairat knocked us out, I started doing the same again for next season, thinking, right, who are the potentials? Where is the worry here? And that's when somebody said to me, where's the worry here? We failed to get through qualifiers 5 times in a row. Why are you so confident that we'll do it next time? And I'm really, when you put it like now, that, I don't know why I was so confident. Every one of these teams is fucking danger to us. Every one of these teams could put us out. And the more of the games we have to play, the less likely it is we're going to make it. It's ridiculous.
Rick, hold on. We've been going for 100 minutes. We'll have a word from Eric and then a farewell from Boise.
Just one point, that's all, and I'll finish up on this one. You know, if we were ambitious enough to go and land somebody like Kjetil Knudsen, okay, he operates, again, on a fraction of a budget in comparison to ours at Bodø Glimt. Yet he's able to deliver success by their standards, by a club of their size's standards. He's able to deliver European success season after season with them. And if our board was willing to bring in a manager like him, he's not going to spend a fortune, because if he had autonomy, he has an eye for a player, just like Ange Postecoglou had. Ange Postecoglou didn't spend a fortune at Celtic. He was very shrewd in the players that he brought in, especially the players that he brought in from Japan and the prices that he paid for them and the timing of the way he brought them in. He knew exactly what he wanted to fit into his system. And that's the thing with the likes of Knudsen. He knows what he wants for his system, and he won't spend an absolute fortune to do that. But if he was
full judgment to be supported, then
yeah, his way. If he was given autonomy, we'd probably get Scandinavian players, quite a few Scandinavian players into the team who were more than capable of playing in his system. But this is what's needed at our club. We don't need to be spending up. This is like people keep saying to us, you know, oh yeah, well, I mean, domestic dominance and winning domestically is the key. Like, we have to always win. Obviously, we have to win the league to get into the Champions League if we want to have any chance of getting into the Champions League. That's fair enough. But we also have to understand that winning the treble in Scotland lands 5 million. Playing a home game in the Champions League lands 3 million. Playing 2 home games in the Champions League lands 6 million. That's, you know, what we can win financially, domestically, is nothing. We do need to win it to get into Europe and to be able to compete in Europe. But again, I'm just saying that maybe even Wilfred Nancy, these guys aren't going to spend fortunes of money. They're just going to identify decent players. But that's what the club needs to do. They need to give them autonomy. They need to, this shit of emailing Dermot Desmond for approval, all that's got to stop if Celtic wants to have any chance of going forward in Europe. If the board remains in situ, and if Dermot Desmond, which I think is inevitable anyway, he's going to remain in situ. But if the board and he still try to work in tandem together, this club's going nowhere. It's not going to go anywhere. And a manager is going to come in, and if he's told, like Brendan Rodgers was, that he'd get autonomy and he'd be allowed to, you know, bring the players in and he would have the final say in players, which Desmond tried to say that Rodgers had, but that's clearly not the case, because we've seen the calamity that's happened in terms of transfers. We just have to move away from the model that we're currently on. It's self-destructive to the degree that it's landed us where we are right now. It is a self-destructive model now. It's a self-destructive way of operating. And if we continue in that path, we're going to continue to self-destruct.
Right. So we're going to finish up now. You can catch us again next month. You can catch 3 of us. We're not having Boise back. Boise, special rare occasions, special guests only. Us 3 Trinity Tims back next Monday at 6:30. You can catch me on Video Celts. You'll get Eric on Read Celtic, and you'll get James on the Celtic blog. Over to our special guest. Where can we catch the Boise bus?
Nice one, Joe. Appreciate that. I thought I was getting chucked off there for good. I thought that was, you know, he'll not be back. I thought, all right. Well, I like the fact you've just done it very Dermot Desmond-esque in public. No, thanks very much for having me on. Appreciated it. The Boise bus is obviously on YouTube. That's pretty much our main sort of photo. We've got like the TikTok channel as well. Boise cleverly spelt with an H after the B, you know, just to, so it all works out. But aye, catch us on there. We're always on a Thursday night. It is sporadic between Monday and Wednesday when we get on. We've all had busy lives and stuff. I only do it sort of as a hobby, but I think we've got, we were saying up to 5,200 subs now. So we've done okay in 4 or 5 years. So I'm chuffed with that, to be honest. It's just something I do on top of my full-time work. So yes, more of the same sort of chat that you get on here. Probably less articulate and less researched, but colourful nonetheless, I would say. But no, always a pleasure to jump on here as well, and always find it funny that, you know, particularly James and Joe, I don't mean that in a bad way, but like, I remember reading their work as long as, I'm talking 10 to 15 years ago. So if you'd said,
well, boys, they're my inspiration. They're the reason.
Ah, there you go. But if you told me back then reading the blogs, you know what I mean? Like, oh, you'll end up debating with them on Monday nights and stuff like that every now and then. Now you would have, it would have been bizarre. So, no, nice one for having me on again. Absolute pleasure.
Pleasure's ours, mate.
Right, folks, that's all for now. Catch us again next week and do all your sharing, subscribing, and hopefully we're through the 2,000 barrier and chasing after Boise and his 5,000 mark before you know it. Cheers.
Okay, see you later, guys. Have a good one.